As that character of Daniel Deronda begins to help others in the book, so I think the book intended to change the world.
The Tikva Fund presents the theme of beauty and goodness, the first episode of an 8-part series on George Eliot's classic novel, Daniel Deronda, led by Professor Ruth Weiss. For 2 decades, Weiss was a professor of Yiddish and comparative literature at Harvard University, where she pioneered the academic study of Jewish and Yiddish literature. Now a distinguished senior fellow at the Tikva Fund, Professor Weiss also writes about contemporary Jewish affairs in the Wall Street Journal, Commentary Magazine, and Mosaic. She has written many books, including Jews and Power, The Modern Jewish Canon, and most recently, No Joke, Making Jewish Humor. In 2007, President George W. Bush awarded her the National Humanities Medal.
This is an introduction to one of the great novels, one of the greatest works of fiction, I think, that has ever been written. It's an extremely exciting book of ideas. It explores some of the most important ideas of its time and of our time, like nationalism, liberalism, family life, and social life. This book is magical. It has a special meaning for Jews, because 20 years before the rise of Zionism, it put forth the idea that Jews had to reclaim their national sovereignty in the land of Israel. It is a tremendously important book for England and for Europe, because I think it foresees many of the problems that arose in Europe as a result of Europeans not being able to understand how the Jews fit into their midst. The idea of opening up a book like this is pretty daunting because this is really a great novel. And so what I'd like to do at the very beginning is just to try to introduce it. So some of the themes that we're going to be looking at are the question of beauty versus virtue as dominant criteria for how you judge people and situations. The idea of forbidden love, which is so attractive in the romantic tradition, as opposed to love, which is sanctioned by community and sanctioned by the sense in yourself that this is right for you. Then we will be looking at really also the dislocation that is beginning to enter into British society. The fact that people have a lot more opportunities now than they ever had before, that men and women are now free to shape their own future. But what does that really mean? How do they know the good from the bad? How can they distinguish what is expected of them? So this is the way the novel opens up these themes, and that's what we'll be exploring. It is an incredible pleasure and a tremendous privilege to be here with you to study one of the great novels of the great age of the novel. And that is Daniel Deronda, which is the crowning work of George Eliot, who was then, in 1876, at the peak of her powers. This was the last novel that she wrote, and in the consideration of some people, the best, but certainly the most ambitious. Her life is an example of genius, which was perfectly matched to opportunity, in the same way that we see musicians like Bach and Mozart making the most of the musical opportunities of their time. She turned to fiction, and particularly to the novel, at the moment when writers like Jane Austen and Charles Dickens have proven its cultural and social impact. But I think they had not yet exploited the form to its fullest potential. It was really ready for her talent. So prose fiction had begun to flourish with the development of mass printing and the emergence of a literate readership, in England particularly, was ready for this hybrid form of entertainment and enlightenment. England, you know, had a relatively literate public, a free press, a society whose class structure was beginning to encourage greater mobility and to allow for personal ambition on the part of men and women. People had always told stories about the shepherd, the poor shepherd who wins the hand of the princess, about the girl who must be saved from the wicked witch or the wicked wolf. So the novel undertook to follow these kinds of adventures, but in the lives of what seemed to be real characters in real situations. And this book, I think, undertakes a lot more than that. It invites us to see how a long-suffering and careworn people wins the heart of the British, and how that great nation improves and gains as a result of being able to understand and to accept the Jews. George Eliot was a philosopher. She began by writing philosophic essays, and she began by translating important German philosophic texts. In fact, she was in the process of translating Spinoza when she began to write novels. Now, her choice was to move from the world of philosophy into the world of fiction, which one might think is a very strange move. But I think she made that move not because she ceased to be a philosopher, but rather because of her understanding of life, which led her to the conclusion that fiction, particularly the novel, particularly the far-ranging novel of ideas, could do greater justice to the philosophic ideas that she was grappling with than essays or polemics or any other form of philosophic writing. And in a sense, I think that those who read her novels could be persuaded of it, because in addition to all the ideas that are embedded in the novel itself is its own proof. It has everything. You know, there's no aspect of life that seems to be missing from this novel. And the point is that if you really take life seriously and ideas seriously, you have to see how all these things are meshed, intermeshed one with the other. When we learn from her biographers that Queen Victoria was one of her earliest and biggest fans, this is not only some royal commendation like a Medal of Honor. George Eliot then knew that she could influence the people who guided and who set the tone for the country. And as that character of Daniel Deronda begins to help others in the book, so I think the book intended to change the world. So our author, Mary Ann or Marion Evans, who took the masculine pen name George Eliot when she published her first fiction in 1858, could have figured as the heroine of one of her novels. She lost her mother early in life. She received a very strict religious education, which exposed her to the Bible. She knew the Bible very well. She knew classical religious literature very well. And she was a pious Christian throughout her adolescence, and then a thoughtful rejecter of Christian faith at the age of 22. She was one of the most intelligent thinkers and deeply read persons of her generation. Everyone points to the paradoxes that define her. With no formal schooling beyond the age of 16, she edited the leading British literary journal, the Westminster Review. A champion of morality, as we see in this book, she entered into what was considered a scandalous relationship with a married man, George Lewes, who was unable to divorce his wife. Her defiance of propriety made her something of a social pariah for many years, until her literary accomplishments and her reputation became so great that her fame cleansed her reputation. So some of the details of her life will emerge during our discussion, but for the most part, I want to concentrate on the novel as a complete work, a masterpiece that stands independently of its creator. So George Eliot is going to make herself known to us through the characters and through the narrator of Daniel Deronda. And let me just say that I remain fascinated by the phenomenon of the good novel. Here is an inert object, thousands of words on hundreds of pages that can be pulped as easily as it can be printed, right? A couple of inches on a shelf. Yet you read such a book And you get to know life sometimes more vividly than you do when you are experiencing it. And if we then try to understand it together, as we will be doing here, it becomes a touchstone for how we think and how we live. So Eliot, or George Eliot, as I'm going to refer to her, set out to redefine and to rehabilitate the idea of nationalism. And what she did is at least as important today as it was 140 years ago. One could say that if she had really managed the task that she set herself, we wouldn't have to be having the same discussions as we had 140 years ago. On the other hand, it is quite remarkable that this book, I think, raises the questions that we are still addressing among ourselves, very seriously addressing, because these are the questions that face us no matter where we live. I think that if you're talking about the problem of nationalism, and especially of Jewish nationalism, and you want to make a case for nationalism not as an evil, as we tend to think about it, the evils of German nationalism, the problems caused by the extremes of nationalism anywhere. But if you want to talk about the healthy parts of nationalism, the part of the human being that really is part of a nation, that is part of a larger family, then I don't know a better novel to do that. I don't know a better text to do that with than Daniel Deronda. In an essay that George Eliot wrote immediately after completing this book called The Modern Hep 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 about anti-Semitism, she writes about this explicitly. She says, look, every people looks back on its own past with pride and is happy about the continuity of the nation. The Greeks, the Romans, even the Italians look back to their Roman past. And we British, we take such pride in the fact that we can look back to the kings of yore and to the beginnings of the British people. Now, why don't we feel that way about the Jews? This is a good for every people. And she says this explicitly, that if you feel this about the British, if you feel this about other nations, you must also understand how important this is for the Jewish people. So let's proceed through this novel more or less chronologically. It plunges us into the adventure of a man and woman powerfully attracted to one another across a crowded room. The compressed opening paragraph holds the key to their romantic prospects. So I think that we want to turn the key a little bit to unlock the scene. Was she beautiful or not beautiful? And what was the secret of form or expression which gave the dynamic quality to her glance? Was the good or evil genius dominant in those beams? Probably the evil. Else, why was the effect of that of unrest rather than of undisturbed charm? Why was the wish to look again felt as coercion and not as a longing in which the whole being consents? Now, beautiful is the standard descriptive term for every fairy tale heroine. The other day I was reading my granddaughters the storybooks that they handed me, actually. The first was the story of Rumpelstiltskin, and it begins, once there was a miller who had a beautiful daughter. Then came the story of Sleeping Beauty. A very long time ago, in a magical kingdom, a beautiful princess was born. So no more need be said. A beautiful daughter is everyone's idea of a story's proper subject. In folklore and in the romantic fiction that developed and drew from fairy tales, a beautiful heroine combines physical and moral perfection. Her beauty is literature's shorthand for an ideal that doesn't need precise description. Beauty compels our attention, invites admiration. But here we are warned against the very assumption that traditional romances ask us to make. The subject of this paragraph is certainly alluring, but rather than inspire us with confidence,
Her beauty calls its power into question. Was the good or evil genius dominant in those beams? Now, Helen of Troy's beauty was said to have caused the Trojan War, so we are very well aware of the dangerous potential of beauty. But here the moral question overtakes the erotic attraction. This woman's beauty, her loveliness, her appearance, commands a second look, but the viewer warns himself that her aesthetic and erotic appeal may be at variance with her moral essence. Now, it is really important here also to recognize whose perspective is this. There is in this book the very strong perspective of the narrator, who often intercedes and tells us what to think about situations and tells us what is going on in the minds of the characters. But here, the perspective is unmistakably that of Daniel Deronda. So this is something to bear in mind. It opens with that amazing paragraph, but this is known to be his perspective. So it arranges or rearranges our associations of loveliness around a different set of criteria from the usual ones. So this is more than a warning about the subjective or relative judgment, as in the expression, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Now that's also, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but this doesn't say that. These questions explicitly subordinate the value of beauty to that of goodness. And I find this opening one of the most aggressive in fiction. It really throws down the gauntlet. And here's what I mean by this. So Romanticism, the Romantic movement, had elevated the appreciation of beauty as a virtue, and the idea of aestheticism was coming into vogue at the time that Eliot wrote this book. There were poets and thinkers who held that the refinement of sensibility, that making us able to appreciate beauty, and especially sublime beauty, would cultivate the moral impulse in us. In other words, by refining our taste, we could refine morality. And I think that this idea may still underlie some of the assumptions about art appreciation or about parts of a liberal education. But this opening shoots that down because it sets beauty and goodness off against one another as competitive standards of judgment. And then there was the adoration of art as an end in itself, given classic expression in Keats's Ode to a Grecian, Ode on a Grecian Urn, you know, which many of us thrilled to in college, and I hope that some of you still thrill to wherever you are in your education. Now, the poet Keats, or the poet whom he's representing here, looks at this ancient artifact with its scenes of men or gods chasing maidens whom they will never catch, or seeing the scene of a sacrifice being performed that is going to stay immutable. And these are actions that are going to remain unconsummated. But he finds in them, because they are there in perfection on this urn, he finds in them the answer to mutability, to change, to death. So his adoration of deathless perfection of a work of art ends with this deathless passage, which if you don't know it, certainly you've heard the last part of it. When old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in the midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man, to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. That is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know. So, Keats doesn't just plunk down this quotation. It arises from the evidence that he provides in the poem, which is also that perfect work of art. So its exact meaning has been debated ever since the poem's first appearance in 1820, but there is no mistaking that his idea of beauty is linked with truth. there is no mistaking either that George Eliot was floating this idea, this linkage, by insisting that beauty is linked to virtue. Right? But the most immediate irritation or provocation that prompted this paragraph may have been the publication in 1873, just at the time when George Eliot was beginning to work on this book, of Walter Pater's study in the history of the Renaissance, that went much further in defining art for art's sake, or I would say rather, defining life for art's sake. What Pater and other aestheticists were doing is actually saying that life should imitate art, that art, the perfection, what one looks to in a work of art, captures in a great work of art, is what we ought to be aspiring to in our everyday lives. So he wanted, and I quote here, to burn always with this hard gem-like flame, to maintain this ecstasy, that is success in life. And this was in reaction to the rise of the bourgeoisie. It's against the idea of the bourgeois repetition of habit and stereotype, against the idea of tradition that we accept, against the norms of family life, of civic duty, the virtues of good citizenship. Pater believed in cultivating a desire for beauty, a passion for the arts that could stave off mediocrity. And you recognize at least one thing, that Gwendolyn, our heroine here, is also very keen about never being mediocre, never being middling. So George Eliot wrote to a colleague when Pater's work appeared that it was, quote, quite poisonous in its false principles of criticism and false conceptions of life. And she believed and said that the great art was meant to improve life and that to cultivate morality, you had to do just that. Cultivate moral behavior. As one literary historian put it, the battle lines were drawn between the literary realists who sought moral purpose in art and the aesthetes. So this is the ground that we're on, and I think that you can feel George Eliot drawing her bow in this classic struggle. So that's one, I think, way in which this very short beginning really challenges in ways that her readers would have perceived, right? A certain set of assumptions and a certain growing idea that, you know, just look at the way we live. So boring, so, we say, everyday. That's the expression we use for that kind of boredom. So everyday. And here we have Eliot saying, you look at beauty, beware. This is not the code of judgment. This is not your criterion. So the opening, I think, also challenges another very important idea, and that is the idea of romantic love. A man and a woman are seeing one another for the first time, which is how the standard love story begins. And yet we are offered an approach to their attraction that contradicts and opposes the chivalric idea of love, the idea that the person who wrote most keenly about it, Denis de Rougemont, calls love in the Western world, which is the passion that you'll all recognize of star-crossed lovers, of a man and a woman forbidden to one another. Forbidden love is the driving idea behind the incomparable love story, medieval love story of Tristan and Isolde. I must say, I've never read a love story to compare with it. It is just, it can change your life, I think, at a certain age, possibly not in the best direction. And it is the assumption of the Shakespearean tragedy of Romeo and Juliet and all its offshoots. And may I add here, not irrelevantly, It is the assumption behind the Hollywood treatment of Jewish intermarriage, from the jazz singer through Annie Hall and way beyond. The premise of love in that model is don't, therefore do. She is wrong for you, therefore you must make her yours. And that ideal of romantic love pits the lovers against the norms of the community, their family, their ancestral tradition, and it shows itself victorious through either a happy ending or in death. Leonard Bernstein, composer, Arthur Lawrence, librettist, and Jerome Robbins, choreographer, all Jews, originally conceived of West Side Story, their most famous collaboration, as East Side Story, in which a Lower East Side Jewish Maria was supposed to fall in love with the Italian Catholic Tony, and the rumble was going to coincide with Easter Passover. So that was their first conception. They later changed the Jewish Emeralds, the gang of the Emeralds, to the Puerto Rican Sharks. But the idea of forbidden love remained the same. So romance between Jew and Christian, between Jew and German, nowadays between Jew and Arab, remains a staple of the Jewish romance, though one has to say that in America, intermarriage is becoming so common that there is hardly enough taboo to keep the tension dramatic. But the young man here in our story does not fit this pattern. See, he knows that something is wrong when the wish to look again felt as coercion and not as a longing in which the whole being consents. The positive idea of attraction between a man and woman ought not to pose a challenge, much less to provoke a conflict, but it rather should inspire a longing for completion, for fulfillment, in which the whole being consents. God looked at his work and he said, it was good. And man who was made in the image of God should be thinking the same. The whole being includes the body and the soul, and it looks for harmonious resolution in everything that matters. So at this early stage, we may not know what constitutes his whole being. What is meant by that? His whole being consents. But we do know that the man looking at this woman wants coherence rather than a romantic chase. He wants love that reinforces the best in him. So the opening thus promises that this will either be an anti-romance or a romance that redefines the genre by validating harmonious fulfillment rather than the impossible dream, that validates something whole even about the community of which a person is a part over that individual wish to break away from it. So the element of longing certainly remains, but it is a longing in that really memorable and phrase that will repeat itself, as we will see, a longing in which the whole being consents, a longing that will bring to consent, not to its opposite. Now, I don't mean to get ahead of ourselves, but I do want to suggest how assertively this book introduces its characters and its point of view. Quote, she who raised these questions in Daniel Deronda's mind was occupied in gambling, which may help to explain why this male viewer resists this young lady's charms. Evidently, and we will see this later, he disapproves of gambling. But we quickly learn something interesting, that his scruples seem also to have an immediate and adverse effect on her. Somehow his disapproval, which is telegraphed across that crowded room, turns her luck from good to bad. She feels it happening. It seems that she too has a moral sensibility, though hers is slower to evolve. His disapproval stops her gambling, although she doesn't stop soon enough, and it awakens something in her that she later calls conscience, and that she wants very much to satisfy. She registers that judgment of his, and it eventually transforms her. You see, this book could have been called The Education of Gwendolyn Harleth, because there is a Bildungsroman. There is a the novel of education forms part of this, and it is her development, her education, and he is certainly the instrument that awakes that stirring of conscience. So the entanglement of this man and woman who are acutely aware of one another is explored from a point of view that values integrity, the consent that we are talking about here, over Byronic rupture, over yearning, craving, pining, aching, and tragic desire. In this book, moral awareness is as acute as, if not even keener than, aesthetic appreciation and erotic attraction. But a question arises. If this book isn't the standard love affair of two young people, who are obviously supremely aware of one another, why then does it introduce them to us in this way? Why raise the questions, the expectations of one kind of love story if you don't expect to, if you don't intend to satisfy its demands? So I think this question remains open as we read. But the dichotomy that it sets up between beauty and goodness puts us on notice of the change that it is introducing. It intends to reorient rather than satisfy our expectations of romantic love and all that implies. And I would say that implies a lot because of the degree to which culture and literature are invested in that other kind of proposition. So stories that pit true lovers against the conventions and expectations of their society, whether they end happily or tragically, engage our sympathies against propriety, against community, on the side of individual passion. On the other hand, stories in which the heroine learns to love the most suitable as well as the most honest suitor, someone who would be acceptable to her father, put it quite bluntly, right? Those stories engage our sympathies on the side of tradition as a positive value. So fiction, we know this, great fiction, is not just a means of whiling away the hours in escapism. And I think that that's one of the ways in which we can really distinguish between escapist fiction and great fiction. But for people who no longer take their instruction from religious authorities, which was the case of George Eliot and the case of the people with whom she was surrounded, for such people, where are they going to get their moral instruction? If religion and traditional authority were no longer going to be the basis of your moral code, of your code of action, what was going to replace it? Without question, she felt that the best bet was the novel. The best bet was a novel like this that could engage your sympathies, your feeling on the right side of morality, as it were, turn them around, because this was not going to be easy, and take you from wherever you might be, from whatever assumptions you might have, to some new consideration of the world, some new way of delineating right from wrong, social good from evil. So the nature of love, we know, is fundamental to the building of the good life. And this novel is going to organize a way of thinking and feeling to which the whole being can consent. Now, one other thing here. We are also shown in this opening why this should be so important. Why has this become so important at this given moment? So from information that is supplied almost immediately, we learn that the people in this book are at risk, right? It opens, as we surmise from scattered internal references, in 1865 in a place called Lubron, which is a fictional German resort city with a large gambling casino that attracts vacationers from England as well as from across the continent. The woman gambling, she of the ambiguous beauty, is Gwendolyn Harleth. Who is there? Is she there on her own? No. She is there as the guest of the wealthy Baron and Baroness von Langen. Although the opening point of view is that of Daniel Deronda, as he intently watches the young woman win and then, under his stern eye, begin to lose, we are introduced to him only indirectly at first. When Gwendolyn sees him again that evening and is, of course, curious to know who he is, she says, "Mr. Vandernoot, you know everybody. Who is that near the door?" "There are a half dozen near the door. Do you mean that old Adonis in the George IV wig?" Which is a description clearly intended to make this gentleman seem ridiculous. No. "The dark-haired young man on the right with the dreadful expression." "Dreadful, do you call it? I think he is an uncommonly fine fellow." So, pressed by Gwendolyn's questions, Vandernoot informs her that the young man that she is asking about is Daniel Deronda, reported to be related to Sir Hugo Mallinger, with whom he has come to the hotel. Gwendolyn is intrigued, and she would like to meet him. But before she is able to do so, she is recalled home by a letter that she receives with very sobering news. And so they do not meet until the following week, when they are back in England, by which time we've learned more about Gwendolyn and more about her life until that point. In fact, if you notice, by that time, we are in chapter 29 in book 4, which has led some readers to think that the novel consists of two parts that don't organically belong together. And this is a criticism that more than one person has leveled against this book. Now, we'll take up this objection by and by, but George Eliot, who faced this criticism very early on, assured such critics that she meant, and I quote, "everything in the book to be related to everything else there." And I think that the close reader can take her at her word. The distance between these two principles and the setting in which they catch sight of one another is at the very heart of the issue that this novel investigates. Because by the latter part of the 19th century, the emerging liberal society of England was far less stable, far less knowable than what came before it. And the circumstances that connect and disconnect and then reconnect the people in this book attest to how unsteady the society has become. Just as Gwendolyn relies on hearsay to find out about Deronda, others are asking about her. "I hear that girl has lost all her winnings today. Are they rich? Who knows?" Who knows? Who knows that about anybody? Well, so the novel then testifies to an expanding and an unsettled world in which what we know about people is partial and in flux and very often unreliable. Now, in George Eliot's previous novels about British society, we are grounded in townships where neighbors often know too much about one another, and they assume everything that they don't know. By contrast, look at this novel. It begins on foreign soil, among people who learn about one another from gossip and from opinions that are largely based on externals, appearance, rank, reputed wealth. Britain's greater openness to continental influence is also perfectly obvious here, because it is also reflected in this opening sequence where British citizens of various ranks intermingle with Germans as their monarchs did through intermarriage, through miscegenation. So now you have the British really exposing themselves, and by the way, George Eliot and her man she called her husband, George Lewes, very often visited the continent, became very well acquainted with the German intelligentsia and German society and German ideas. But here it is represented not through an intellectual salon, it is represented at the gambling table. And then this is, look at the description and how, you know, the tone in which this description is given to us. So it says here, "Those who were taking their pleasure at a higher strength were absorbed in play. They showed very distant varieties of the European type, Livonian, that is Estonian and Latvian, Spanish, Greco-Italian, and miscellaneous German, English, aristocratic, and English plebeian. Here, certainly, was a striking admission of human equality. Sarcasm is that wonderful thing that's through this book, whatever you might call it, irony, sarcasm. So look at that. Here, certainly, was a striking admission of human equality, really. You read that description of the bejeweled dowagers and this little boy there who's there and so forth, and these people from all over. Is that the kind of international community that one is hoping for? This is the verdict on internationalism. So early in the book, right? This is what's coming across here. You think you go to Germany and you imbibe. You think that now the world is becoming one and we're going to take the best from one another and we're all going to gather in a great international set and society and we're going to be exposed to one another's ideas. It's all going to be one. Really? Look at the beginning of this book. Look at where they meet, how they meet. Look at what constitutes democracy. The gambling table, right? This is not accidental, friends. This is set up right here at the beginning. So I think that this tone tells us what she thinks of this new kind of internationalism based on people's readiness to gamble together. And by the time that she wrote this book, as I say, George Eliot could draw on notes that she had made during extended visits to Germany. But this is less about European culture than about its destabilizing effects on the English. British society is in flux, dangerously in flux, and the Englishmen touring the continent to complete their education are no longer visiting a sound place of instruction. And to the Brits among you, my apologies, this is not my verdict. I am just pointing out that this seems to be, at this point, the books. So, since Daniel and Deronda and Gwendolyn Harleth are introduced in contrast to one another here, it's worth noting that they also have a lot in common, and a lot in common that relates to what I have been saying. These are things that matter. They are both at Lubron at the invitation of titled aristocrats, but without any independent financial or hereditary standing. Gwendolyn is with the von Langens, loosely defined relatives who are so tangentially related to her that when Gwendolyn's mother writes to inform her that they have lost all their invested money and summons her home immediately, she leaves the hotel without informing them of her reasons, and she is careful not to incur any further debt to them so that she may not be able to repay. So, you can see, these are not relatives. These are not relations that she can in any way count on. And on first learning about Daniel in chapter 15, we find that he has no idea of his actual parentage, only that his benefactor and guardian, Sir Hugo Mallinger, is not his parent as he had originally thought and hoped. So, Daniel's position in society is inherently uncertain. So both these young people belong to the growing class of citizens who are theoretically free to make their own way in a still highly stratified society. But how and with what guidance and by what rules and according to what values? That the two pivotal figures in this British novel first appear around a gambling table at a German spa at 4 o'clock in the afternoon cannot fill us with confidence about their lives or their prospects. In fact, at this point in their young lives, they are socially and existentially adrift, having to make very fateful choices about marriage, career, way of life, without any ostensible direction or goal. Their attractive appearance, therefore, is woefully at odds with their, I would say, pretty unattractive situation. So I said that these are people at risk, and risk is a permanent feature of the modern condition. And it's with that risk that we begin this book. The letter that Gwendolyn receives is about the bankruptcy of a company in the commercial panic of 1866 that affected its stockbrokers, much like the stock market crash of 1929. So the timing here is a little 1865, 1866. So capitalism creates opportunity, no doubt about it. Modern society encourages social and geographic mobility. Gambling is remarkably democratic. Emancipation emancipates. The greater dynamism and openness that characterize modern life are all in display in this opening chapter. But the book, I would say, looks at progress much the way that Deronda looks at Gwendolyn. Is the good or the evil genius dominant in that condition? When you see Britain gambling away or gambling with its future, do you think that the country is going to improve or decline? So one of the first responses to this book, and one that pleased the author very much, may I say, came from a German Jewish scholar, David Kaufmann, a German scholar, David Kaufmann, I suppose. Writing with special Jewish appreciation for this special treatment of Judaism, he says, I quote, "The meditative reader will guess for himself how deep a lesson from a moral and national point of view is inculcated by the circumstance that Gwendolyn and Deronda are not finally made one." What most excited Kaufmann, the Jew, is precisely what disturbed so many of her British readers and some of the great critics, right? What do you mean? What is this Deronda section doing in the book?
Readers did not understand how these two plots fit together, to the point that some of the English critics wanted to pull away the Jewish part of the novel, and one of the great British critics and teachers, Leavis, actually rewrote the novel as a novel having to do only with Gwendolyn Harleth. On the other hand, the Hebrew and Yiddish translators cut away a lot of the English part of the novel because they didn't want to include it. They thought that the novel could be perfectly fine as just part of what it had. So the question remains for us, really. George Eliot says that everything in the novel is interconnected with everything else. And of course, she was at that point at the peak of her powers. So of course she knew what she was doing. And this is really the gist of it, that she was not answering questions about one group or another. She was asking the great questions of her time. The question of what is nationality? What is nationalism? This was a time of emerging nation states. Was this good or was this bad? And how is it working? So this is one huge question. And the best way of answering it was to put these two people together in the same book, the Jewish people and the English people, and to see what was nationhood in relation to both of them. What could one learn from these two in contact with one another and really in contact with one another in the book? So this is one thing. Then there is the theme of increasing individual freedom, liberty, a great theme of the time. Everybody understood that the rights of man, the concept of the rights of man, was giving a lot more freedom to women, to people who were disenfranchised because they were not the aristocracy, because they had a lower level of education, to minorities. I mean, this was a time of wonderfully emerging individual freedom. But again, George Eliot saw in this a tremendous problem. Supposing what you thought was freedom from obligations, freedom from who you were in the past, was that really the kind of freedom that you wanted? So again, she has these two groups, these two people, these two contexts for asking the same kind of questions. What did it mean for the woman, Gwendolyn Harleth, and what does it mean for the Jew, like Daniel Deronda, and for the other Jews in the novel? Was this freedom a wonderful, liberating thing? Were people going to be able to make themselves happier? Was the country going to be better for it? Or did it have some kind of liabilities and dangers? And then just one other theme, and these are by no means exhaustive themes, there was a theme of liberalism itself. So you had a liberal democracy, but what did it mean to have a liberal democracy? Everybody thought, and it is such a remarkable thing, greater tolerance, greater openness, greater exchanges among all kinds of people. What we would say today, multiculturalism or diversity is sort of what it became. But she noticed something, the author noticed something extraordinary and was very quick to notice it. That in a sense, some of this liberal democracy was like Christianity in that it assumed that everyone would have to enter its embrace, that Christianity was a higher form of religion, that Christianity was a more embracing kind of thing. She realized that liberalism could be like that too. Well, in a way, there was that concept of toleration, which was, of course, something that she wanted to welcome and to appreciate. But supposing what it really became is, hey, I am so tolerant. I am so willing to embrace you into my way of life. Why would you want to stay different? Why would you want to stay separate? Which is the question, particularly for Jews, who in order to remain Jews would have to remain a separate people, to some extent, a people apart, with their own customs, with their own priorities, with their own way of life, holidays, the calendar that they observe, the days of the week, the Sabbath, the separation of milk and meat in the system of kosher. Were you, as a good, tolerant liberal, going to be able to tolerate someone who lived in your midst and was other than yourself, different from you? So these themes, in order to develop them at all, you would have had to bring these two sides of the subject together. So there's no way of pulling them apart. The only way that one could explore them fully was to do them in tandem, to do them together, as she does in this novel. I think we are alerted to this in the very first paragraph. That is to say, why are these two people so powerfully attracted to one another? Let's not minimize that. I mean, we would be doing the book an injustice if we did not understand that they are powerfully attracted to one another, right? And yet, he says that how deep a lesson from a moral and national point of view is inculcated by the circumstance that Gwendolyn and Deronda are not finally made one. So this is what one of the things that we will look at. And for now, I think this is the beginning. Thank you. So really, I think the question that one would leave coming out of this lecture is, so what going forward is the future for these two young people who meet under these circumstances? The question in any romance at the beginning that's set up this way is, will they or won't they? Is this going to lead to a happy marriage? Is this going to lead to their happy ever after? Or is there something that is going to prevent this from happening? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? So I think that's the main question that's posed by this kind of opening of a novel. And that question hangs over the whole rest of the book.
For additional information about the Tikva Fund, please visit tikvafund.org.